This chapter 22, an extremely familiar and I think very practical story for each of us in our lives. Our subject this morning is true discipleship, and we shall be studying an example or illustration of true discipleship from the story of Genesis chapter 22. I think it can be well said that true Christianity as well as true discipleship is an all-out commitment to Jesus Christ. Someone has said the Savior is not interested in men and women who will give to Him simply the spare evenings of their week, or the weekends of their month, or the years of their retirement. He is concerned and interested in men and women who will give Him first place in their lives. H.E. Evan Hawkins, in his InterVarsity book called Henceforth, writes, "He looks today as he ever looked, not for crowds drifting aimlessly in his track, but for men and women whose undying allegiance will spring from their having recognized that he wants those who are prepared to follow the path of self-renunciation which he trod before them." I find it extremely strange and somewhat convicting that in America today we accept so freely the fact that our young men in the military give their lives for a patriotic cause. We do not even find it difficult to understand how a communist can give his life for a political cause. We virtually enshrine a man who sacrifices his wife, his children, his home, and in many respects himself, in order to make it to the top of the world of business. Many of us literally fall on our knees before the athlete who has self-denial and in unusual discipline made it to the top and excelled in the world of athletics. Many of us, tragic as it may seem, actually encourage our children to bury themselves in a career that will give them some status and security and the comforts of life. And yet, we consider it extreme, radical, and actually fanatical to speak of an all-out commitment to Jesus Christ. Yet, my friends, that is true discipleship. It is a complete commitment to Jesus Christ as Lord in every area of one's life. I suspect we find few more beautiful and more appropriate illustrations of true discipleship than the one in Genesis chapter 22. It is the extremely familiar story of Abraham offering his son Isaac. We shall read the first 14 verses of the chapter for our illustration this morning. "And it came to pass after these things that God did," the King James says, "tempt," the New Scofield says, "test," and that is the significance of our word, "God did test Abraham, and said unto him, Abraham, and he said, Behold, here I am. And he said, Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. And Abraham rose up early in the morning and saddled his ass and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son and cut the wood for the burnt offering and rose up and went unto the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said unto his young men, Abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder and worship." The first occurrence of this word in our Bible, What a tremendous context for this word to occur. We will go yonder and worship and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac his son. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and they went, both of them, together. And Isaac spoke unto Abraham his father and said, My father? And he said, Here am I, my son. And he said, Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, My son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. So they went, both of them, together. And they came to the place which God had told him of. And Abraham built an altar there, and laid the wood in order, and bound Isaac his son, and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched forth his hand, and took the knife to slay his son. And the angel of the Lord called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here am I. And he said, Lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram, caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram, and offered him up for a burnt offering in the stead of his son. And Abraham called the name of the place Jehovah Jireh, as it is said to this day, In the mount of the Lord it shall be seen, or perhaps, more accurately, in the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. And may the Lord bless to our hearts now this reading from His Word and our study together of it this morning. This is an illustration of true discipleship. The illustration gradually unfolds before our eyes in three major movements, verses 1 and 2, verses 3 through 12, and then verses 13 and 14. And we shall study these three basic movements through the illustration that is given to us. Undoubtedly, Abraham's life consistently was a life of testing. When he was called to leave Ur of the Chaldees, it was a test. When he was promised to have a son in his old age, it was a test. When he was called upon to exile or expel his son Ishmael from his home, it was a test. But in verses 1 and 2 of our chapter, we come to the supreme test in Abraham's life. You'll notice that the test that Abraham has in these two verses is a test that finds its source in God. It's striking that the source of this test is not Abraham. One would almost think that this would be a possibility. He obviously was brought up in a culture where human sacrifice was a very common thing. Abraham had often stood and many times had heard of the sacrifice of a firstborn to an idol. And it is not very difficult to imagine Abraham asking himself, as he would hear of a neighboring family offering up their firstborn as a human sacrifice to their God, Do I love my son, or do I love my God enough to offer my firstborn for him? And although that is a very legitimate possibility, yet the striking thing from our passage is that that is not the source of this test. Our passage is exceedingly clear when it says, And it came to pass after these things that God did test Abraham. If the source is God, then we immediately ask ourselves concerning the purpose. What is the purpose that God has in mind as He moves to test Abraham at this particular point? I think it can be clearly said that the purpose was not to satisfy Satan. This is one of the common interpretations given to our story by Jewish scholars. Between chapters 21 and 22, they interject a little conversation between Satan and God, much like the conversation in chapter 1 of the book of Job. Satan turns to God after the banquet that Abraham has given at the weaning of his son Isaac in chapter 1 and says, "Do you see that, God? Abraham had a great big banquet there for his son Isaac, and he didn't give you one single thing of it." And they suspect that God turns to Satan and says, "But Abraham gave that banquet in honor of his son. And if I had asked him, or if I were to ask him to give his son for me, he would do it." And then the Jewish scholars say, "And it came to pass after these things, after this conversation between Satan and God, that God did test Abraham." Now, there's absolutely no support in our passage or in the Word of God that this is the purpose of the test. Mind you, sometimes in the life of a Christian, that is the background of the testing of a child of God. The book of Job teaches us that. But that is not true in the test that we have in Genesis chapter 22. I think it can be just as confidently asserted that the purpose of this test is not to punish Abraham. Again, this is one of the very common interpretations given to our passage, again by Jewish scholars. They reflect upon the covenant made between Abraham and Abimelech at the conclusion of chapter 21. And they suspect that this was a wrong thing for Abraham to do. The land had been given to Abraham and to his seed. And for Abraham to enter into a covenant with this king of the Philistines, it was a wrong thing to do. And as a result, it came to pass after these things, the covenant between Abimelech and Abraham, that God did come and he tested Abraham, or in a sense he came to chasten him or to discipline him. Now again, we might say that oftentimes this is the occasion for God moving into the lives of his children with times of testing, with times that do bring great grief. It is the chastening of the Lord. But that is not true in Genesis chapter 22. I think we can also just as confidently assert that the purpose of this testing is not to cause Abraham to sin. James chapter 1 teaches us very clearly that God cannot be tempted by sin, and God never tempts to sin or with sin. God is not moving in the life of Abraham at this point in order to tempt him to see if he will fall. Then, what is the purpose? The purpose is neatly hidden for us in the word that is used for this word test in chapter 22, verse 1. We have read, "And it came to pass after these things that God did test Abraham." And the word that is used here is the word that is frequently translated in the Old Testament, prove. For instance, it's the very word used in Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 2, when the prophet Moses says, "For this reason God did lead you through the wilderness these 40 years in order to prove you." In order to prove you, so that, says God, so that I might know what is in your heart. Now, one of the very common things that God does in the lives of his people, Old Testament and New Testament, is bring them into situations where he tests them, where he proves them, in order to bring to a surface some of the qualities that he has been developing in their life. In order to bring to a surface the very finer things and the best things in that individual's life. Seems to me that the best illustration I have heard of this is this type of situation. As the Ford Motor Company will soon be putting its 1972 models off the press, one of the first things they will do will take that motor vehicle to their testing grounds. Now, what is the purpose that the Ford Motor Company has when they test Fords? It is to demonstrate the best and finest qualities that they have put into the Ford automobile. If, on the other hand, Ford happened to take a General Motors vehicle to those same testing grounds to test that vehicle, what would their purpose be? Here it would be to bring out the weaknesses of that vehicle. Now that is the difference between God testing and Satan tempting a child of God. When Satan comes to tempt a Christian, his purpose is to bring out the worst in us, to cause us to stumble and to fall. When God comes and tests his children, it is like Ford testing their own automobiles. It is to demonstrate the fine qualities they have put in it, so that it will be a reflection on their workmanship, and it will be to their glory, and through that testing, to further perfect the qualities that they have brought into that automobile. Now that is the purpose behind our passage this morning. God is going to test Abraham. And the purpose of this test is to bring to a surface the qualities of Christian character that he has been developing in this man of God down through the past 30 years of his experience in walking with God. But you ask, what really are the qualities that God is concerned about in the life of this man, Abraham? That comes before us when you move into verse 2 and you notice the nature of this test. The source is God. The purpose is to prove him and to bring out to the surface the best qualities. Now, in verse 2, the nature of the test. God says, take now thy son. This test is to include the most cherished, precious possession in Abraham's life. That's obvious from the way these words pile up. Take now thy son, thine only son. In the Hebrew text it is, whom thou hast grown to love, Isaac. Isaac is right at the end. This test is to include the most precious possession in his life. Josephus calculates that Isaac is at this time 25 years of age. That seems to be a little extreme, but he's a grown man. During this time, Abraham and Isaac have developed a friendly, intimate relationship. The most beautiful relationship that can exist other than a husband-wife relationship. That of a parent and a child. The father and son relationship. The test is to include the most precious possession. What is he to do with them? Well, he goes on to say, and get thee into the land of Moriah. This test is to take place at a particular geographic spot that subsequently will become the most significant spot on the surface of this earth. It is in the land of Moriah. And what is he to do there? And offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. The test is to include an almost unbelievable sacrifice. It is the sacrifice of his son as a burnt offering, the only offering in the Old Testament that was completely consumed by fire and completely given to God. That is the test that God has for Abraham. When a child of God and a man of God comes to the moment where God tests him, he comes to the most strategic and crucial moment of his life. And Abraham is at the moment of the supreme test of his entire life. When you face the test, you almost ask yourself how God could ask for such a thing. For example, the immediate question that comes to my mind is, does God ask Abraham to do something at this point which God himself does not approve of? Because often through the Old Testament, he forbids human sacrifices. How could God ask Abraham to offer his son as a human sacrifice when God says, on at least 4 occasions and perhaps many more, do not offer human sacrifices? Seems to be a problem, doesn't it? It adds to the problem when you consider the possibility that what God is actually doing at this point is leading Abraham toward committing a sin. And what one asks themselves at this point is it possible for God to lead a Christian in a way that's contrary to what he has said in the Word of God? These problems and questions begin to tumble out when you start thinking of the tremendous test that is before Abraham. Now, because this is such a crucial problem, I'm going to take 3 or 4 minutes and very quickly try to give you several points that will, I hope, help to resolve the problem of God asking of Abraham a human sacrifice. The several points are these. The first point is this. God does call upon Abraham for a physical sacrifice. Some very prominent scholars today are suggesting that God is not asking for a physical sacrifice from Abraham, purely a spiritual sacrifice. Abraham misunderstands what God says because he uses the terminology of a physical sacrifice, and God has to stop him before finally he offers that physical sacrifice. Now it seems to me that that is a great evasion of the problem. God is obviously calling for a physical sacrifice by the terminology he uses and by sending him to Moriah, that little nestle of hills where the city of Jerusalem later was to be built. The second statement that I'd like to make on the problem is this. God is not categorically opposed to human sacrifice. Now, do not let that startle you. But God is not categorically opposed to human sacrifice. There was one human sacrifice that he sanctioned and ordained, and it was the sacrifice of his own son. So God is not categorically opposed to human sacrifice. The third thing that I would like to say about this is that God has every right to ask for the life of Isaac. God was the giver of Isaac's life. Morally, God has every right to come to Abraham and to ask him for the life of his son. Also, God not only morally he has the right, but theologically he has the right, because Isaac is a fallen man, and the wages of sin is death. And the consequences of Isaac's fall and life of sin is death. And so theologically, God has every right to come to Abraham and to ask him for the sacrifice of his son. The fourth thing that we should say is this. The idea of a human sacrifice was not nearly so abhorrent to Abraham as it is to us today. Abraham had seen it many, many times. It was the highest form of worship in the Canaanitish religion. And Abraham, apparently, when God asks him to offer his son as a sacrifice, does not think that God is asking him to do anything wrong, anything immoral, anything that contradicts what he has said. There is a fifth thing that certainly must be said, and it is this, that when God does not permit Abraham to offer his son Isaac, God is openly condemning the practice of human sacrifice. Abraham is about to kill his son. God stays his hand and stops it. Why? Because God does condemn the practice of human sacrifice as it was taking place among the Canaanites and as it could have developed among the Jews at a later date. So God does condemn the practice of human sacrifice as it was being practiced by stopping the offering of Isaac. The next thing that must be said concerning this fact is that when God provided the ram for Abraham, providentially, on the top of that mountain, God was decreeing not only that human sacrifice should not be made, but he was decreeing that the death of an animal should take the place of that man who was fallen in sin. What he was really doing was establishing for Israel once again the principle of substitution. And that was why God providentially provided that ram. The last thing that I want to say about it is this. God is not guilty of deceit or of any pretense when he asks Abraham to do something that he never intended Abraham to do. That is one of the problems that comes to our mind. But God is not guilty of pretense. He is not deceiving Abraham when he asks Abraham to do something that he never intended Abraham to do. God still does the same thing today. If I had time, I could tell you in detail the time that my wife and I went through a very, very definite time of exercise about going to the mission field. We believed without question that God had called us to the Congo. We spent our lunch hours together reading from a French Bible in order to acquaint ourselves with the language. We had already made approaches to our elders in our local church and told them that we felt that God had called us to the mission field, and we had made several other arrangements. And then, strangely and miraculously, God changed the entire direction of our life. And as we look back upon it today, we see that we had exactly the experience that Abraham had. What God often does, as he does with Abraham, is call him and us to do things that he never intends for us to do in order to prove us, in order to exercise us, in order to bring to a surface the qualities of Christian life to see whether we are willing for such a thing. So there is no problem here with God calling upon Abraham for a human sacrifice. The question that immediately comes to our mind is, what qualities is God concerned about in the life of Abraham? What is it that he wants to bring to the surface, that he wants to display, that he is going to test and prove? There are three of them. The first is Abraham's obedience. This specific command, take now thy son, thine only son, whom thou hast grown to love, Isaac, and offer him as a burnt offering. That specific command was so personal and so penetrating, it was the supreme test of Abraham's obedience. The thing that is being tested in this chapter, my friends, is Abraham's subjection to the will of God. But there's a second thing. It is Abraham's faith. The contradiction between the promises that God had given for Abraham and Isaac and the command to offer Isaac as a sacrifice makes this a test of faith. The real issue that faces Abraham at this particular point is this. Can God and will God fulfill his promises to Isaac if I obey him and offer him as a sacrifice? So Abraham's faith is being tested and proven at this point. But there is a third thing, and I think it is this third thing that we generally overlook. In its final root, the thing that is being tested in this chapter is Abraham's love. And the supreme issue that faces Abraham at this point is, Abraham, do you love me more than Isaac, the most precious, treasured, cherished possession of your life? Who do you love more, me or Isaac? That is the test. And as we face the test, as it's presented to us in these first two verses, we're almost overwhelmed. But then we come to the second section of our chapter, verses 3 through 12, and find that after this supreme test in Abraham's life, you come to the greatest triumph in his life. And the greatest triumph is developed for us in the three stages according to the three things that are being tested. The first stage is Abraham's obedience. And Abraham passes the test so beautifully in verse 3 where you see his instant obedience. And Abraham arose early in the morning. The next morning, early the next morning, what instant obedience. Abraham passes the test perfectly. It's difficult to say when God really spoke to Abraham. When God did come to him, he said, Abraham, get thee and thy son there. There's a little Hebrew phrase that Luther interprets to mean, Abraham, you and you alone go there and tell no one else. This is a test only for you, Abraham. And I'm inclined to agree with Luther. I do not think that Abraham told Sarah anything about this. This was just between Abraham and God. And early the next morning, Sarah does not know anything of what is happening. Early that very next morning, he cuts the wood, loads the animals, calls the servants, gets his son, and they start off on the trip. And at the very beginning of the story, Abraham's instant obedience is reflected. And he passes the test beautifully. What Abraham is simply telling us and what God is telling us at this point is that here is a total submission to the will of God in his life. The second stage of his triumph comes with his implicit faith. The question you see this morning, my friends, is, what is it that brings into the life of a believer instant obedience to the will of God? It is always an implicit faith in him. And so following his instant obedience comes the implicit faith. And that is apparent to us in what he says in verse 5 to the servants. Abraham says to these two young men, "Abide ye here with the animal." If they had gone, they obviously would have protested what Abraham was going to do, and there would have been a great skirmish on the top of that hillside. This was just between Abraham and Isaac. And so the two young men are left behind. Now notice what he says. "Abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder, and we will worship, and we will come again." This is a first-person plural verb. We will come again. Abraham's implicit faith in what God is going to do. We are going to go, we are going to worship, and we will come again. We do not understand exactly the thinking in Paul's mind and Abraham's mind until we come to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 19. And there, the author to the Hebrews tells us that it was by faith that Abraham offered up Isaac. What type of faith? Accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead. And so as Abraham turns to his sons and says, "We will come again," he is prepared to go to the altar and to sacrifice his son with the implicit faith that God will raise his son up from the dead, give him life again so that the promises can be fulfilled. You see, Abraham had a remarkable belief in a God of resurrection. That belief was born at the birth of his son. Because you see, when Isaac was born, it was a life from death. And Abraham's belief in a God of resurrection stems from the birth of Isaac from a womb and a man's body that had died. But as we move on through our passage, we discover that Abraham's implicit faith is further indicated in verse 8. "And Abraham said to his son, 'My son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering.'" I suspect that Abraham's heart is somewhat breaking in half at this point. He's incapable of giving to his son an honest answer, a full answer, a complete answer. Where is the victim for the sacrifice? And in his love, he restrains himself. In his faith, he expresses himself. And he says, "God shall provide himself a lamb for the burnt offering." And as the test begins to unfold, Abraham's faith comes to the surface. And he passes the test beautifully. God is displaying to Abraham, to himself, and to all of the world, the implicit faith that this man has in a God who is able to bring life out of death. But the thing, you see, that really challenges my heart this morning is, what is it that produces such implicit faith in the life of a believer? I see then, you see, that obedience is the result of faith. But now I see that faith is the result of love. And as the story continues to unfold, Abraham's unrivaled love for Jehovah soon becomes before our attention. Verse 9, "And they came to the place which God had told him of. And Abraham built an altar there. He laid the wood on the altar, laid it in order, and then he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood." What a spiritual giant that young man Isaac must have been. Every thong that was wrapped around his wrists spoke of his confidence in his father, who he knew would wish him no harm. Every thong that was wrapped around his ankles spoke of his faith in God, whom he knew would fulfill his promises. Isaac's silent and complete submission to the will of God speaks of his all-out commitment to him. He was a spiritual giant. But Isaac's commitment is only outdone by Abraham's. Can you picture it, my father friend? He takes that big man and lays him upon the wood. Then with an icy cold hand reaches for the knife, grasps it so tightly that his knuckles begin to whiten. Then he lifts his eyes to heaven, whispers a silent prayer, raises his hand and closes his eyes because he cannot look upon his son. And then he stops breathing for just a moment. And it is at that moment that Abraham's unrivaled love for God is demonstrated. That's why the voice shatters the silence. Abraham, Abraham, lay not thy hand upon thy son, neither do thou him any harm, for now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thy only son, from me. My friend this morning, that is true discipleship. Now I know that thou fearest God. There is an absolute submission to the will of God. Complete instant obedience. There is a complete faith in God and in His program. And there is an unrivaled love that God is loved supremely and solely more than any other cherished possession on the face of the earth. And that is true discipleship. Abraham has demonstrated that to him, Jehovah is number one in his life. Here is the all-out commitment in the life of this man of God. Now, lest we think this is just somewhat unrelated to our lives, may I ask you to turn to Luke chapter 14. In this chapter of Luke's Gospel, our Lord Jesus is addressing a large group of would-be followers. And as he speaks to them, he clearly addresses them with the terms of discipleship in the life of a Christian. In Luke chapter 14 and verse 26, he says to these people who are mulling around him and who would follow aimlessly in his track, be the weekend or the years of the retirement to be given to him, to this group he says, "If any man come to me and hate not his father and mother, and wife, and children, and brethren, and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple." That, my friends, is the test of true discipleship. It is the cost of true discipleship. Abraham demonstrated that he loved God more than Isaac. He loved God more than Sarah. He loved God more than himself. That is true discipleship. Will you allow me a very personal story? I don't often tell real personal stories, but this one I cannot avoid because it is so significant in my life. 4 years ago, I was speaking at a conference when I received a phone call in the middle of the morning from my brother-in-law, who is a medical doctor, telling me that my father's illness had just been diagnosed as cancer. 2 years ago, he was hospitalized. Since then, he has not been able to move from his waist down. He is bedridden, partially paralyzed, and a very ill man. When we came to the end of our seminary training here, one of the major decisions in our life was where we should go. We felt a compelling obligation to our parents, who in the latter years of their life were very much in need of us because they had no immediate family at home with them. Many of you who are our close friends will remember that last Christmas we went up to Canada and we were making a decision. And one of the things that we needed to weigh very, very carefully was our responsibility to our parents and how our parents would respond. One day my father asked me to come down and visit him alone in the hospital. And as we sat and talked, he said that what he wanted me to do more than anything else in making a decision as to where we would go and what we would do after seminary was to not consider him or my mother, but to consider only the Lord's will in our lives. And I can tell you that never did my father seem so big, never did he seem such a great man as he seemed there laying partially paralyzed in that hospital bed. And I saw in my own experience one of the greatest pictures of true discipleship that I have ever read of or I have ever seen. And I have seen since that time the tremendous sacrifice that my parents have made when they made that decision to not consider themselves, but in fact what they did was sacrifice me to the Lord. Now, I'm going to speak very candidly about this subject, my friends, because I feel that one of the great tragedies in many of our lives, and one of the great hazards in the work of God, is that you and I are exceedingly selfish with our own lives and with our own children. I wonder how many of you parents this morning have ever given your children without any selfish consideration for God's will for their lives. I wonder if you would be offended or upset if God called your children to the mission field. I wonder if you encourage them to consider the possibility of full-time Christian service. Spurgeon once wrote to his son and said, "Son, I would be extremely disappointed in you if God called you to be a missionary and you turned out a millionaire or you became the drivel of a king." That's discipleship. And I tell you, my friends, that's the story of Abraham and Isaac to us this morning. Abraham demonstrated his obedience sprang from his faith, but his faith sprang from his love. And Abraham loved God more than anyone else, more than anything else in this earth. He demonstrated that he hated his father and his mother and his wife and his children and his own life also. That's discipleship. I become very, very disturbed when I hear many students, especially, and some of our seminary friends, speak of discipling other Christians. What a watering down of discipleship. No individual can disciple any other individual. Discipleship is an all-out commitment to Jesus Christ, when He and love for Him alone is the supreme motive in our life. And I should ask myself this morning, as I ask you, if God should move into our lives at this moment for the supreme test of our life, to touch the thing that we consider dearest of all in our lives, what would He touch in your life? Would it be your wife? Perhaps it would be that only son. Maybe it would be your business. Perhaps it would be your own personal health. Maybe it would be some form of recreation or some area of your social life. I suspect that many of us would find it very difficult to say what it is on earth that we cherish most of all. But God knows. And if God moved into your life this week, my friend, to touch that thing, as He did with Abraham, I ask you, would you be willing to give it? You say, "I don't know." And you're a wise person if you say that, because you don't know. But I ask you, would you be willing to give that? You say, "But I really don't know." Well, then let me put it this way. God is asking for that at this very moment, because that is the cost of discipleship. The cost of discipleship is not some test that He is going to bring into your life this week when He shall remove someone that is a very loved person from your life, or your business shall go bankrupt, or your health shall evaporate. That is the test. But God asks for that thing that is cherished most of all to be laid on the altar before Him. He asks to be loved supremely in our life, apart from that test. And as I face it this morning, I ask myself, to what degree is there true discipleship present in my life? He says, "If any man come to me and hate not his father," that is to love on a lesser degree, "his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple." Verse 27, "And whosoever doth not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." And as though the Lord has not said enough, He concludes in verse 33, "So likewise, whosoever he be of you that forsaketh not all that he hath, he cannot be my disciple." And the true cost of discipleship, then, my friend, this morning, is not just bringing that thing that is cherished most of all in my life and laying it on the altar before the Lord and saying, "Lord, I give that to you. I love you more than that." But it is bringing everything that I have, all of my possessions. It is forsaking it all and laying it all on the altar and saying, "Lord, I love you more than anybody else or more than anything else in this whole earth. You are supreme in my life." That's true discipleship. That is all-out commitment. You say, why should I do it? Why did Abraham do it? He was motivated. Motivated by God's grace, by God's faith. What is the motivation in our life? Abraham stands on that hill in a few moments, and he gives it its name, Jehovah Jireh. That word means, the Lord shall provide. And Abraham is saying, whenever a child of God comes to a time of great testing, God in His providence moves in His grace, and He meets the need and supplies for that person. Moses, in writing it in the next verse, says, even unto my present day, says Moses, people still say, in the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. And Moses is saying, even unto our present day, people say, whenever God moves into the life of an individual to test him, God providentially will move to provide for their need and to give them the strength and the ability to cope with that testing. But there is much more in the name Jehovah Jireh than that. God shall provide. That name was given to Mount Moriah. A number of years later, Solomon built his temple on that mountain. For 900 years, offerings and sacrifices were made in that very spot, the Temple of Jerusalem. 900 years later, a cross was erected on this very spot.